Up next, in search of the supernatural, we're going to talk about hauntings as we go live to the United Kingdom in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Looking forward to this couple hours with a very special guest, Dr. Kieran O'Keefe, applied psychologist from the United Kingdom, extensive media and academic experience in investigative psychology and parapsychology. He's done some research on the mental maps of serial killers as well. His master's degree examined the utility of psychic detectives, which led to a PhD focusing on psychics and mediums. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Hello there, Doctor. Good to have you.
Good morning, George. How are you?
I'm great. Tell me, how did you get so interested in the paranormal field?
Well, I guess it started as a boy, always being fascinated by ghost stories. In fact, my parents were quite worried about my reading habits, reading a lot of Stephen King, Clive Barker, but also some of the classic Gothic authors such as Byron, for example, H.P. Lovecraft. And so I had that interest in ghost stories anyway, I guess as most kids do in terms of being being scared. And then as I grew up, I was reading Unexplained magazines, which was a quite a popular magazine here in England in the late 70s, 80s. And then, you know, I could wax lyrical about some sort of intellectual inspiration, but it was actually the movie Ghostbusters that really got me involved in parapsychology. that's when I really heard the word parapsychology, and so much so that I even called up Columbia University at the time when I saw the film and inquired with them about their parapsychology unit, only to be told, of course, that there was no parapsychology unit. But luckily, the lady I spoke to told me about the Institute of Parapsychology and Institute of Parapsychology in North Carolina that was connected to Duke University.
Yep, Ron, the Rhine Institute, almost, yeah?
Yes, yeah, the Rhine Research Center, yep, as it's known now. And that kind of set me off as a young boy in terms of looking at the academic side and thinking, well, this is something that I would love to do as a career, if it's possible. And yes, part of it was kind of a boyhood fascination with being a Ghostbuster, but it was a little bit more than that. It was really getting into some of the subjects that parapsychology covers, you know, telepathy, precognition, clairvoyance, that sort of stuff, PK. And as a result of that kind of interest, I ended up doing a degree, undergraduate degree in the States at Washington College.
What a great journey for you.
I know.
Great journey.
Well, I was in a position where I had looked at possible university pass or university options in the UK, and really they were only offering postgraduate education in parapsychology. So a lot of your listeners will be aware of the parapsychology unit in Edinburgh, for example, the Kersler parapsychology unit,
yeah.
And it was really only postgraduate stuff. So the encouragement was from any of these parapsychologists is go away and get a degree and then focus maybe towards the end of the degree or at a master's level or PhD level. And so, yes, I ended up in the state at a liberal arts college of all places, just because in being interested in parapsychology and psychology, I'm also a musician. And so I was looking for somewhere where I could do a degree in music, but also my other area of interest in parapsychology.
When you hear the word parapsychology, Kieran, what do you think of? I mean, because it's pretty broad. There's a lot of different things in that field. What do you think of?
Well, it's different for me as a trained parapsychologist. Straight away, I think of parapsychology as the scientific study of experiences, which I guess in principle are outside the realm of human capabilities as we currently know it in conventional science. And if you break that down into its relevant categories, parapsychologists primarily study ESP and PK and survival. ESP, extrasensory perception, covers telepathy, precognition, and clairvoyance. And clairvoyance is not clairvoyance as we know in terms of mediumship. It's when, say, for example, if you were to draw a picture in an envelope put it in an envelope and ask me to work out what that drawing was, I might try and interact some way with the actual drawing, and that would be a form of clairvoyance. Now, of course, ESP is a controversial one because parapsychologists recognized very early on with their studies, if you get apparent telepathy in a laboratory, how can you distinguish between telepathy, precognition, and clairvoyance? Whether it's mind-to-mind communication, or I had a dream a few days ago about the result that was going to occur in the laboratory and tapped into that when we ran the experiment, or is it some form of clairvoyance? So ESP is one area of parapsychology. PK is the other. Now, PK or psychokinesis, a lot of people will be aware of macro PK, that is, things that you can see. And so PK is the action of the mind on objects, trying to get objects to move or manipulate in some way.
Have you seen that happen at all?
I have seen it happen, or the claim of it happen. So I was quite fortunate to meet Yuri Geller.
Oh, yeah, we know Yuri well. He's been on the program a number of times. You know, he's been criticized a little bit, Kieran, from the appearance that he did years ago on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, where he basically panicked and could not bend the spoon. And, you know, he normally does it, which led, you know, some skeptics to say that, you know, it was fraud and trickery all the time. But I have also talked to a lot of people, including an astronaut who was on the moon, Edgar Mitchell, who swear by him and his ability. So what do you think of him?
I err on the side of skepticism. Part of that is because of my parapsychology training and being aware of the studies that he was involved in at Stanford Research Institute, Targ and Puthoff, and kind of it's a controversial series of studies that he was involved in there. And in parapsychology, certainly when we meet at nights in pubs and have drinks, it's a topic that comes up quite regularly, and it does split the field. There are some people who think, or some parapsychologists who think, there might be something to Yuri. And certainly there are some tests that he did in this country with a number of physicists who were looking at the objects that he bent. And they were showing with their machines or their calibrated machines that you would need a machine to bend some of these large iron objects that they had him bend in the laboratory. That there's no way you can actually bend it with your hand, essentially what they were saying. And for me, that's quite convincing evidence that you've got somebody here that can bend an object using their mind. Because if you can't bend it with your hands, then it immediately negates the possibility of any form of trickery, which is the main skeptical argument against him.
If you can bend it though with your mind, does that tell you that there's some kind of force, a field that is doing that?
Well, yeah, there could be a number of different theories. You know, I'm trying to think if you, for example, look at Sheldrake's work. Rupert Sheldrake, a famous parapsychologist here in the UK, who talks about something called morphic resonance. And he has this theory, exactly what you're saying, that there's some sort of force at work, that either we have a force that we impinge upon another object, an invisible force that causes that object to move, or you have another theory, which is that somehow there's some form of communication that works between the mind and the molecules of that particular object, and almost persuading, for want of a better word, those molecules to move. Or, of course, it's some sort of micro-PK that your mind is actually causing those molecules to move. You know, and that's the pro side of Yuri Geller and what he does, and certainly any PK artist. The skeptical side of it, for me, is the quite convincing evidence on the other side, which is to do with trickery. And having met Yuri Geller once face-to-face as part of a haunting investigation that I did with a TV crew. He bent a spoon for me in front of me, but I couldn't discount the possibility of trickery. And then over the course of about 3 or 4 hours, he bent a spoon. spoon for anyone and everybody that asked him to. But having a little bit of knowledge of magic, I could see that there were instances of misdirection. Now, I'm not saying that Uri Geller is a fraud by any means. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that you've got convincing argument on the skeptical side, and certainly I've seen it firsthand, that the possibility of what might be going on is some form of trickery. There's misdirection, there's standard magic tricks in play to make it look as though the spoon is bending using his mind. But then also you get on the flip side some very convincing papers by physicists, and by the sounds of things, your conversations with people, you know, the people of high standing, giving their testimony about things that Uri does. And so I guess what I'm saying is my view on Uri is kind of illustrates my view on a lot of parapsychological phenomena, in that I am truly skeptical, which means I'm open-minded to the possibility, and that I'm not 100% convinced by the evidence either way. I think there's a good argument for what could be going on either side of the debate.
Well, the Apollo 14 astronaut, Edgar Mitchell, was telling me one day, Kieran, that he was meeting with Geller. They were having ice cream and in a little bowl each. And he was telling Geller how he had lost years ago a tie pin that was given to him by our space agency, NASA. Years ago, he lost it. And Geller, while eating his ice cream, reached into his mouth like he had something in there. And he's pulling it out like that. And he pulls it out, and it's the tie pin. It's the pin that Mitchell lost 2 years ago. There's no way Geller would have had that or would have known about it, unless he stole it from Mitchell 2 years ago, but I don't think he did.
Yeah, well, I guess immediately we'd want to know whether Mitchell had released that story publicly before. And by the sounds of things, he hadn't. But, of course, if he had, then that would raise a question. But the fact that he hadn't released that story to the public makes it more convincing.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're dealing with a tie pin, a specific object that is not the sort of object you could just buy on eBay or pick up in any thrift store. You know, this is an object that you would be given, and you'd have to be an astronaut, ultimately. You know, so to get hold of that object and produce it fraudulently, I don't know how that would be possible. You know, there's no way Uri could have got hold of that object. So there you go. That's what I mean. There's testimony there that makes you think, well, these skeptical arguments about trickery, yes, they're convincing, and I've seen evidence of it myself, but then we also have these incredible eyewitness testimony accounts that are very difficult to explain. And although as a psychologist, kind of taking the investigative psychology side of things, I'm aware of issues with testimony, that's something that doesn't lend itself well to exaggeration.
Well, where did you say you were on now, Dr. O'Keefe? Are you on the fence on parapsychology, or are you're not 100% convinced it's real, are you? Not 100%.
Yeah, it's not 100%. People often say to me, you know, how can you be involved in this when you're a skeptic? And I think what's happening is because of the proliferation of various paranormal shows and the bandying about of various terms, that my position as a skeptic is often confused as one of a cynic. And I'm certainly not a cynic. I'm a true skeptic, which means I'm open-minded to the possibility. I'm constantly questioning. And there are areas of research that I'm conducted in, that I conduct, haunting experiences, for example, mediumship, where I'm skeptical and I lean maybe towards slightly cynical. However, there are particular cases. There are aspects of parapsychology, for example, the decade of research into telepathy, the Princeton Engineering stream of research looking at PK. There are these kind of nuggets or highlights within the history of parapsychology that I would defy anybody to try and come up with an alternative explanation for them. I just find them so impressive that even myself as a skeptic, I'm saying I'm open-minded, I'm constantly questioning, but with those particular highlights, I'm convinced by those things. I really am. And you know, I often sit down with colleagues in university, various universities, and they're very dismissive of a lot of this phenomenon. Certainly mainstream science does tend to be quite dismissive of parapsychological phenomena generally. And when they are immediately dismissive and say, oh, no, you know, this is all hallucination, this is all fraud, I say, well, that's not very scientific of you to say that, having not read the evidence. If you read about the evidence and then come back to me with a conclusion and your thoughts on it, then I'd be more impressed. However, it's not very scientific just to dismiss it all with a wave of a hand. You know, we've got some quite eminent scientists in this country who do that, who say, well, I'm not even going to read the literature. I'm not going to read the thousands of cases of mediumship study that occurred in the early 1900s. I'm not going to read the decades of research into telepathy, into Ganzfeld, Ganzfeld approach to telepathy. I'm not going to read it because I know it doesn't exist. So therefore, what's the point? And that, for me, is a really, really poor argument, and it really illustrates kind of bad science. Whereas I'm of the opinion that I've read all of this stuff, and I don't have an alternative explanation for some of these impressive cases, whilst there are other instances where I can come up with very easy alternative explanations for what's going on.
What area of the paranormal would you say you would specialize in, if there is one?
The areas that I specialize in would be in survival, mainly. I mentioned that parapsychology can be categorized into three areas, ESP, PK, and survival. Survival, or other parapsychologists call it after-death communication, would be any form of after-death communication. And mediumship would be a prime example, those that claim that they can communicate with spirit. And then the other form of communication would be haunting experiences. And so this idea that maybe, and it's equatable with telepathy within the field of parapsychology, that if you have a haunting experience, it's a form of communication, albeit you may not get a situation where a ghost is actually standing in front of you and trying to communicate with you. In essence, you having an experience, whether it's a sense of presence, whether it's a drop in temperature, any of these quite common experiences would be an indication that there's some form of communication, even if it's just a departed spirit saying or giving some evidence to show that they're actually there. And so those are two main areas that I'm involved in, and I've been involved in now for over 20 years, haunting experiences and mediumship. And then there's a third area, which is the overlap with my other academic hat, which is psychic criminology, this idea of psychics being involved in criminal investigations.
And they have been, and they do some phenomenal job for police officers. We're with Dr. Karen O'Keefe, of course, live from the United Kingdom, parapsychologist. I would guess, Karen, that some psychiatrists, when they have looked at the cases of the people who are psychics, might say that there could be something wrong with people. I can see how that happens. But what about police departments where somebody comes to them and says, look, I know the body is under this tree, and they go there and there it is. Is that person ever looked at as a suspect?
Well, that's quite an interesting point. And just to tackle each of those points, the first thing you were saying about how psychiatrists could view somebody who has some sort of psychic claim, within earlier editions of the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is a manual of diagnosis that's used by psychiatrists, there'll be some particular disorders within there that would have a psychic element to them.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. We're going to come right back after this commercial break right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to come back in a moment more with our very special guest, Karen O'Keefe, Dr. Karen O'Keefe, as we talk about his work in the supernatural realm. We'll take your phone calls next hour and your stories as well. Welcome back, Dr. Karen O'Keefe, with us. Karen, let's talk about the psychiatrist then, and how they view people of psychic abilities. And you were telling us some stories.
Yeah, there are some, you know, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is a huge book that's used for diagnostic purposes by psychiatrists. Even in there, for some of the disorders, for example, schizotypal personality disorder, one of the symptoms of that is psychic behavior. You know, so there are, I think, 8 or 9 particular things that they would look at for schizotypal personality disorder, and one of them is that there are patterns of behavior that reflect kind of odd beliefs or magical thinking, superstitious belief in clairvoyance, telepathy, or sixth sense, bizarre fantasies, fantasy proneness. And you're essentially describing somebody there who could present themselves as being psychic. And then they could come under a diagnosis. Now, of course, there's other things that would have to go along with that, but immediately a psychiatrist would raise their eyebrows. So that's one particular professional and how they would view somebody coming to them with psychic claims. You said in your question before the break, how does that differ to professionals in the police force?
Yes.
And in police cases where a psychic will come to them and say, look, you know, the body can be found in such and such a place. And your question was, well, could they be viewed as a suspect? And certainly the case in England, we have a lot of psychic detectives, which is how I describe them, who present themselves to various police stations, more so with very high profile crimes, often child abduction cases or serial murder cases, and they'll present themselves to the police station with information that they've got apparently from psychic means, and then afterwards they'll tell newspapers or anybody that'll listen that the police has taken their account and is therefore using it as part of the investigation. And it's almost seen as a badge of ability. And understandably so, because if a psychic is involved in a criminal investigation, they claim to be a psychic detective, then it's great that they are involved in a case. However, the huge caveat with that is exactly what you said, is that if anybody does provide quite key information about a case, the police are under an obligation to take that information down, because they don't know if the information does come from a psychic source or if that person actually knows information about it but is presenting it as psychic, because they don't want to tell, you know, explain where they got the information from. So there is this obligation, and unfortunately it means that in some very high profile cases, for example, of recent years, the abduction of Madeleine McCann, a young girl in Portugal. On that particular case, the police were inundated with accounts from psychics. And here we are a few years later, and we're already at 2,500, almost 3,000 accounts from psychics as to what happened. You know, so the police are under an obligation to take them. But I think in North America, it differs slightly in terms of how psychic detectives are viewed, because various police forces or police officers are in a position where if they have a belief in this particular area, or they've been impressed with psychics in the past, or that colleagues have recommended psychics, then what they might do is actually consult a psychic directly, certainly in murder cases or abduction cases, whereas that option is not available in the UK, and certainly I think it's seen as a lot in a lot more cynical way in the UK than it is in North America. But that said, you know, some fascinating cases in history.
What is all of this, Karen, tell you about the supernatural world? I mean, you know, we're having a difficult time trying to guess and theorize how we got here, why we're here, especially if you take the religious aspect out of it. But,
sure.
But what do you think it is? Was it always part of the universe? Is it something else? What is it?
That's a very good question, and kind of relates to perhaps an evolutionary parapsychology point of view, which is this idea of, especially when you talk about precognition, an attempt to predict the future, It's that feeling often that, let's go back thousands and thousands of years, and evolutionary parapsychologists would argue, as cavemen, we needed some form of early alert system to warn us of dangers around the corner, to warn us of problems. And it's almost as though that particular ability would have been part of us, and would have been something that we could apply at the time. However, in the modern age, there aren't so many dangers that face us, and so therefore it's an ability that's ultimately lost. And that's an argument within parapsychology as to the reason why it's very difficult for parapsychologists to capture something like precognition in the laboratory. However, recent controversy with something called presentiment, this idea that perhaps we've got a very small percentage of that ability still left in our DNA or wherever you want mm-hmm. to put it, and some fascinating research conducted by Daryl Bem in North America, and also there's been some follow-up work here in the UK, and a physicist by the name of Ed May as well has been involved in it. This idea of presentiment, that unconsciously or subconsciously we know if something fearful is around the corner. And the way they set that up is by presenting people with random images, and interspersed in those random images were fearful images. So, for example, a picture of a big spider or a big snake. And they were measuring people's electrodermal activity, but even more than that, various physiological indicators that somebody was afraid. So there's ways that you can do that physiologically quite easily. And what they're showing is in some of these studies is that people's physiological response was triggering before they were shown the image of the spider or the snake. Which really indicates
that's fascinating.
That's
fascinating that they've had that precondition, basically.
Yes, it's some sort of inherent ability that we have to know that danger's around the corner. And there's another aspect of that fascinating researcher, who unfortunately we've lost now, Marcello Truzzi,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a classic book with Arthur Lyons called The Blue Sense, which was specifically looking at psychic detection and various aspects of psychic criminology. But also within that, he was saying that police officers often have this blue sense. You know, they'll be driving down a street, and for some reason, they'll know to stop at a particular house. They'll drive past. They know that something's happening in that house. Or if they go into a house, they know that they get that sense of danger, that there's something there. And so he would argue, and these other researchers that have been doing this presentiment work would argue, that this ability, this precognitive ability to detect danger, is something that we would all have had in the past. We've lost it now because of modern society, but now here we are in a situation where maybe there's semblances of it still left within us. And so I think that's probably one part of it, but of course, I'd love to give you a simple answer, but that for me is a good theory about precognition. With other areas, for example, mediumship and communicating with the dead, well, the whole reason why I'm involved in mediumship research is ultimately, I guess, for three reasons. Number one, because in testing mediums and looking at mediums, you could provide evidence, potentially, to support survival of bodily death, which, of course, is one of the great life questions.
That's our quest, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, maybe mediumship, or looking at mediumship, is one way to go. And they claim to be able to communicate with spirits. So if you can prove that in some way, then that would ultimately be proof. I mean, of course, it would challenge key assumptions underlying kind of neuropsychological research, personality, cognition, but also even physics, you know, so it'd be hugely controversial. But also it's an area that I think it would be arrogant for psychologists and parapsychologists to ignore. when we know that there's this huge belief in it, you know, in terms of recent polls showing that you've got 30% plus people believing in mediumship, and then that percentage only increases if you then ask people whether there's any afterlife. And so, looking at mediums, looking at haunting experiences, and the reason why people get involved in ghost research maybe is part of that great quest to find out if we do survive after death.
What do you think of those who channel, or they say they channel?
Generally, I'm not impressed, which kind of goes against the atmosphere that I'm putting across for your listeners that I'm skeptical. Immediately, my response to that is no, I'm not impressed. There might be cases that other people know of that are impressive, but for me, having investigated now in excess of about 50, 60 channeling cases, it's the information that comes out that would be more evidential for me. Some of the most impressive channelers in this country have either channeled supposed aliens from other planets, or they've channeled often Native American Indians, or Native Americans, I should say. And they've given information that's quite vague, it's quite ambiguous, and it's not evidential. In particular cases, so for example, Helen Duncan is a medium from about 50, 60 years ago. D.D. Hume, I could also throw in there potentially, although people would say it wasn't necessarily channeling. But there were cases where they came up with information where you could verify that information afterwards, and you could show that it was accurate. The issue then becomes, how did they get hold of that information? Does it come from a spirit source, or were they aware of the information beforehand? And for me, that's a real issue, especially with historical cases, because you're often only dealing with eyewitness accounts within a seance room. And a lot of the channeling cases that I've been involved in, there weren't recordings of it, so you're only dealing with secondhand knowledge of it, or secondhand testimony. And so trying to work out exactly what's going on, how much information was accurate, whether we're dealing with a situation where the seance attendees are reading into the information that's given by the medium, it's a huge kind of minefield to try and work it out. And then there's a flip side to it, which is the paranormal one. If somebody channels another personality and they come up with information that is highly accurate, and that you can establish that they didn't get hold of that information prior to the seance or prior to the channeling, then can you say that they're actually channeling particular personality? Can you actually say that they're getting the information from a discarnate entity, from a spirit? And here's kind of the other minefield of parapsychology in my work. I don't think you can definitively say that that's the case, because even in a laboratory where you can control for all manner of other explanations, if a medium comes up with highly accurate information, whether it's through mental mediumship or channeling, whatever, all you can say at the end of the day is that there's some form of paranormal communication. It could be mediumship, but also that information could be taken out of somebody's head through a form of telepathy. Now, of course, if it's any of that, then that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
Truly amazing, if it can.
It would be amazing. And, of course, it would completely challenge all the assumptions that we have.
I wonder, Kieran, what the possibilities and what the percent of frauds are compared to what you would believe to be real mediums. Is it, I mean, on a 10 scale, 1 to 10, I would say the real mediums maybe 10, 20%. I think it's pretty low.
Yes, and I would agree with you. Now, in terms of, I mentioned about channeling, the number of mediums that I've looked at, or cases I've looked at in terms of channeling, 50, 60, with mediums, because of my PhD and because it's an area of research and I'm fascinated by it, we're now talking 250, almost 300 mediums. And for me, yes, the majority of them are fraudulent, and they're trying to disguise that fact. For another percentage, albeit a smaller percentage, there are those mediums who they genuinely believe that they have an ability, a mediumistic ability. When they're tested, even very cursory surface testing, just you know, actually just talking to them, getting information from them, talking to them about their cases, that sort of thing, you realize very quickly that although they believe very strongly that they have an ability, there's no semblance of an ability there. And then yet there's yet even a smaller percentage, and I would say potentially 10% or less, I wouldn't go any higher than that, who are those that genuinely believe they have an ability, who are not fraudulent, and who may be the mediums that we're looking for.
That's true, and you cannot rule that out.
You cannot rule that out, and William James, the famous American psychologist, one of the kind of founders of psychology back in the 1900s, he said, you know, in order to prove or disprove that all crows are black, you only need to find one white crow. And that's kind of the position that we're in with mediumship, unfortunately, because for me, I find it fascinating, but I've carved out a lifetime career, I think, essentially, because I'm testing all of the mediums, and at the moment, they're all black crows. But I only need to find one white crow to show that there is something to it, you know. And there's, and that sounds very depressing and very cynical, but there are a couple of cases, historical cases, that I think are fascinating, and I wish I'd been around at the time, because they could have been examples of a white crow. And one of them would be Eileen Garrett's work with Harry Price in England, and known as the R101 case, which your listeners can look up. And essentially, she was conducting a part of a seance that was set up by Harry Price, who's a fascinating figure in psychical research and paranormal research, known for his work with Bawley Rectory, which is one of the most haunted houses in England. And as part of this controlled seance, Eileen Garrett came up with information about a crash that had occurred, the R101 crash. And it was literally within days of there being this huge airship crash post-Second World War in France, I think it was.
And hold on for a second there, Karen. We're going to come right back on Coast to Coast AM.